resume our convention with this panel. It's my pleasure to introduce the moderator. All the bios are in your convention app, so I am just going to introduce him as you know him, Judge John Nalbandian on the Sixth Circuit. Very pleased to have you back, Judge.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean. Welcome. Welcome, everybody. It's great, obviously, to be back in person, and we've said that, but obviously it's a great thing, and we are really happy to be here. So I want to welcome everybody to our special session panel. It's entitled Originalism, Perspectives from the Bench. And today we're going to hear from a number of very distinguished jurists about, among other things, I think, how they incorporate originalism and originalist analysis into their opinions, and on advice that they have for advocates to help make them, to help you all make these kinds of arguments, which in turn will make judges' lives easier, and who doesn't want that, of course. So obviously I'm John Nalbandian, I'm on the Sixth Circuit, I'm your moderator. Before we start, I'd like to add a quick personal note. So in addition to marking Justice Thomas's 30th year on the Supreme Court, this fall also marked the 30th anniversary of my starting my 1L year in law school at UVA. A decidedly less significant event in the history of the Republic, I will grant you. However, what it really marks is the 30th anniversary of when I first joined the Federalist Society. And why does this matter, of course? Well, the first publication that I remember reading from the Federalist Society was a pamphlet that contained a speech that was given by then Attorney General Edwin Meese to the ABA in 1985. As many of you students of originalism and the originalist movement know, the topic of that speech was the then somewhat controversial idea that the text of the document and the original intention of those who framed it would be the judicial standard in giving effect to the Constitution. And although the idea of original intent and what some now call original expected application had certainly been around for a while, coming at the time that it did, Attorney General Meese's remarks were a call for a course change over the prevailing views of constitutional interpretation. Now, 1 year later in 1986, Justice Scalia, then Circuit Judge Scalia, in an address to the Attorney General's Conference on Economic Liberties, stated that the quest for original intent was really a quest for original meaning, which later became a quest for original public meaning. And now, skipping over a bunch of history, of course, here we are 35 years later with originalism being one of the, if not the prevailing, most popular prevailing method, at least for interpreting the Constitution, at least we hope. Indeed, you know that you've arrived when you start having fights among yourselves about what I will call nuances in the doctrine. In any event, I'd like to turn to our panel. I'll skip the detailed introductions because I've taken too much time talking about myself, of course, but you can find their biographical information in the conference materials or on Wikipedia, of course. But briefly, we're gonna start with Judge Edith Jones, who has served on the Fifth Circuit since 1985 and is without a doubt the wisest member of our panel. Next, we'll go to Judge Kevin Newsom from the 11th Circuit, or as I like to call it as a former Fifth Circuit clerk, the old Fifth Circuit. And I think it's safe to say that Kevin writes the longest footnotes of any member of our panel. Next, we have Judge Andrew Oldham from the Fifth Circuit, who is certainly the buffest member of our panel. Flash those guns. And finally, we have Naomi Rao from the D.C. Circuit. And of course, given that it's the all-important D.C. Circuit, I wouldn't dare make a joke about Judge Rao. So I'm going to begin by asking the members of our panel questions to prompt a few individual remarks. Then we'll have some discussion. And obviously, we'll turn it over to the audience at some point. So Judge Jones, I talked a little bit about the history of originalism, original intent, and you were there from the beginning. And I wonder if you might add a little bit generally to that history and maybe highlight some of the materials that maybe weren't there at the time you were doing originalism and what you've got now maybe that's different.
There's been a revolution, and that is largely attributable to the founders of the Federalist Society, whether you're in this room or not. I was just reminiscing about this. I took the bench on June 1st, 1985, about 1 month before Ed Meese's speech on originalism. I was the daughter of a doctor and a trained nurse, and our affiliation with lawyers as I grew up was rather small, but I do remember, and skeptical at that, I do remember impeach Earl Warren bumper stickers. And in certain parts of Texas, these were not uncommon because there was a large public anxiety bordering on revolt about the revolution that the Warren Court had wrought in constitutional law. I knew nothing about originalism at the time. I just had the visceral feeling, along with millions of people, that judges shouldn't be telling everybody else what to do. I got to law school in 1971, had the good fortune to be mentored by Charles Allen Wright, who you probably don't even know, participated in defending President Nixon until he felt compelled to resign. And Wright was known as a conservative in the circles of the law school, which was still pleasantly apolitical at that time, but he was really known as the author of the treatise on federal procedure. And there wasn't anything particularly originalist about that, because after all, that was based on the federal rules from the 1930s that had wrought their own very significant changes in traditional procedures. So when I came on the court, not only was I the young whippersnapper, and they wondered how did somebody this age who had been a mere bankruptcy lawyer get to a court of appeals, but I had to earn my spurs, and I was at the beginning of the Federalist Society. The first time I came here to a conference, I think, was in around 87 or 88, where I debated Liz Warren about bankruptcy policy. That established a relationship from which she has never fully recovered. But of course, General Meese was there, and I believe Ronald Reagan gave a speech to the banquet, which was assembled in this room. So you see how the Federalist Society has grown and matured. The whole approach to constitutional law underwent a revolution. Many of us were familiar with what Justice Rehnquist had been doing, largely on his own, for some years. Then we viewed with great excitement the appointments of Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy. Then the elevation of Rehnquist to the Chief Justice, along with Justice Scalia's appointment. Justice Scalia, I think, started the ball rolling with his emphasis on textualism and what, until only a few decades earlier, would have been considered the traditional approach to the law, which is to look at the law in order to interpret it, and not to the spirit and the legislative history and so on. But we had very few resources, very few arguments were founded in originalism. So it really took the inspiration of Justice Scalia, the ongoing inspiration of Judge Bork, even though, well, which was a wake-up call to all of us about the stakes that were at issue in confirmation battles and in the battle of ideas. And then finally, the accession of Justice Thomas, the most dangerous man in America, as one left-wing publication called him, because he and Justice Scalia taught my fine colleagues here what's possible in the law. And I will leave it to them to sketch in the rest of the details. I've been able to study the Federalist Papers, the founding documents on the bench in a way that, as an economics major and lawyer, I had never done. The resources are vast and deep, and hopefully we will be able to tell you about some of those that are available to those of you who are practicing lawyers who will have the chance, I have no doubt, to be calling on originalism in the near future.
Great. Thank you, Judge Jones. Judge Newsom, can you talk a little bit about originalism in practice? I know you've had several opinions that have really delved deep into the original public meaning. I'm just wondering how you do that and give us a little insight.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. I guess I would say two things about originalism from my perspective now as a judge. One, it's really hard, and I'm going to steal a line, not even from my colleague Bill Pryor, but if I'm recalling the story correctly, from one of his former clerks who joked with him that, Judge, originalism is a failed methodology simply because it's too difficult. And, of course, he didn't mean that. But doing originalism and doing it well is very, very hard. It would be much easier to shoot from the hip and decide cases sort of as the viscera direct you, but I don't think that's our role. And so to do it right is it's very, very difficult. I think to be an okay judge would be pretty easy, but if you want to be a good judge, then that's really hard, and that this is part of it. The other thing I'll say about it is that originalism, I have found, is unpredictable. One of the great things, one of the many blessings I think about being a judge, and all of us at one point were in the practice of law. Many of you are in the practice of law, and I love being a practicing lawyer, but one of the things I love most about being a judge is that you don't know or care in advance what the answer is. You actually reason from premises to conclusions, which is one would think is how you're supposed to do it. But as a lawyer, you have a client, and so you know what your endpoint is or should be or what you want it to be, and then you figure out a way how to package the arguments correctly so as to reach that endpoint. We, at least when we're doing it right, don't do that. You just start with the nitty-gritty. You start with the data, and you reason your way through it, and when you've finished reasoning your way through it, you write it up. And originalism is part of that sort of devotion to what I somewhat boy scoutedly maybe would call objectivity in the law. Like, I actually believe that the law is a real thing and that it can be sort of studied and deduced. And I think originalism is part of that, along with its running buddy, textualism, which is, something that you tend to think of in statutory and regulatory cases. But originalism is so both hard and unpredictable. What I mean by unpredictable is, when you're reasoning from the raw data to a conclusion, you don't know where that is going to take you when you begin. So for instance, Judge Nalbandian mentioned that I had tried this. I hope I've done it well. I've tried to do it well a couple of times. And in one of these instances, for instance, I came ultimately to the conclusion, which I think we may have, sort of reasonable disagreement about on the panel even, that the Supreme Court's Article III standing jurisprudence, I can't sort of make square with what I take to be the original understanding of Article III. So that was an unpredictable thing for me. I couldn't have seen that coming. I certainly didn't have it like out for standing. I never really sort of thought about it one way or the other until, as I said in this concurring opinion, after several unsatisfying experiences with it, I wondered if there might not be a better way to think about it, which caused us to go back. I say us because this is a team effort. I can't do this on my own. I think Judge Oldham will talk about this to some extent. But I count on law clerks as well who care about getting the law right and who care about reasoning from first principles. And so this was an us project. And it took us sort of trying to rewind the tape way, 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 way back and figure out what we thought the better answer was sort of going forward. I think the things that I would want sort of aspiring originalists to know in advance, this is sort of like fair warning, walk into this with your eyes wide open. If you want to call yourself an originalist, A, you are choosing a difficult path. It would be easier to do it otherwise. I happen to think that this is sort of the faithful way to be a judge when interpreting the Constitution, but it's hard. And it's also unpredictable. You may or may not like, quote unquote, like the answers that your originalism machine spits out. But that, to my way of thinking, is what it is. It's not my job to improve the law. It's simply my job to find it and interpret it as best I can. I think Judge Oldham has some sort of practical advice that he's going to give some of you in the audience. But I just want you to know, again, as originalists or aspiring originalists, that it's a difficult path. I think it's a righteous path, but it's a difficult path and a very unpredictable path as well.
And Judge Oldham, obviously, if you want to address some of that, that would be great. But also, I know you do some teaching and follow pretty closely what's going on in academia. I wonder if you might kind of talk a little bit about what's going on in academia and maybe how it is or is not helpful to what you're doing as a judge.
Yeah, that's yes. Thank you very much. And I guess I'll pick up where Judge Newsom left off and weave back into sort of the intersection between the academy and the bench. One of the things that I've been most struck by in thinking about constitutional questions that come up in our cases is that by the time the case gets to the Court of Appeals, certainly by the time it gets to the Supreme Court of the United States, the case is on a trajectory, largely determined by the parties, sometimes determined by exogenous events. There's been briefing and argument and all sorts of development in the case. And sometimes there's an originalist argument made, sometimes there's not. Sometimes the originalist argument that is made is good, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's not easy to tell if it's a good originalist argument or not. One of the things I'm most struck by, in particular, as the consensus around originalism as a valid, if not the most compelling way of understanding the Constitution's meaning has continued to grow and grow year in year, is that there seems to be this view that I can make a legal argument and then I just cite a case from the 1720s and that's originalism, which is incredibly frustrating to try to do. You would never do that if we were talking about the meaning of Title VII, you wouldn't just cite a case and say, oh, well, here's one case that supports my understanding of what the text of Title VII means. So it's not obvious to me why people think that they can just, it's like the whiz-bang factor of seeing a CCD citation from 1726, and I go, oh, well, then that must be what the Constitution means. So by the time it gets to the court and it's been litigated and the parties have presented their arguments, it's often too late, to say nothing of the time frames that we have to decide these cases under. Our court gets thousands and thousands of cases a year. You can't just sit and take 9 months to go down and try to figure out the original public meaning of the free speech clauses in the Constitution. And so one of the places that we look, in addition to, as Judge Newsom points out, to our law clerks who can help us do this, is to the academy, where there are people who are paid to do, among other things, legal research. And one of the things that I have been most struck by in the years that I've been on our court is the divide between what courts do and what legal academics do. And I mean that in kind of two different ways. So I'm thinking about the legal academy generally. So this is not just folks who are in the academy and who are originalists and doing originalist things, but just the legal academy generally is often just has nothing to do whatsoever really with what courts do. And I think that's striking. I don't mean to suggest that academics should be focused exclusively on courts and that courts are somehow the most important thing in American law, far from it. But I do think it is kind of amazing sometimes when you pick up a prominent top 14 law review and it seems to have little or no bearing whatsoever on just law generally. Like Judge Jones, I am the child of two doctors. And so when I was a kid and I was, you know, going through the mail or sitting at the kitchen table, there was often a copy of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And at least in the 80s, I was in kindergarten, I guess, when General Meese gave his speech. But we didn't have
time for my afternoon nap.
I didn't see a copy of that on the kitchen table, but we'd often see the Journal of the American Medical Association, and at least in the 80s, when you would look at JAMA, it was about medicine. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, law reviews are the sort of professional publication of our practice, and I'm just sort of struck by just generally what legal academics are doing. But then secondarily, and perhaps more relevant to the audience and our topic for today, I'm often struck by what originalist academics are doing. And it is so highly theoretical in general. There's obviously lots of exceptions, and I want to talk about at least a couple of those. But in general, a lot of the academic originalist discussion that we seem to be having, at least at the moment, is about good originalism, bad originalism, originalist methods, originalist theory, that is, you know, sort of what is the provenance of originalism, what is the normative value of it, kind of these big picture things. And I think that's probably really important, and I don't mean to suggest that it's not, because if we don't have that debate, then you could leave thinking that all you need to do is cite a case from CCD, Pennsylvania in 1728, and you've won your originalist argument. So we need to talk a little bit about what it means to be an originalist, how to do originalism, sources and methods kind of originalism. That's important. But from what we do, by the time the case gets to us, what we really need to know is what is the original public meaning of the speech clause or the free speech clause in the First Amendment, or what is the original public meaning of the non-delegation doctrine, or what did that mean at the founding, that kind of idea. And, you know, I don't pick the non-delegation doctrine at random. I was quite pleased to see that the Yale Law Journal published an article on that last year from Professor Warman, and that's great, because at least then you have an article that you can look at. And that doesn't mean it's right. It still needs to be tested in an adversarial, you know, way. There needs to be criticism of it, and we need to fight about whether, you know, gets the right answer. But at least it's a starting point. And it's way more helpful to the project of trying to figure out a non-delegation case or whatever the thing is that's in front of us than just, you know, another article that's about theory or hypotheses of normative value that come from originalism.
Great, thank you, Judge Oldham. Judge Rao, and maybe you could tell us a little bit or talk a little bit about originalism, what you've noticed, the originalism and practitioner arguments on the D.C. Circuit.
Sure, and I can maybe pick up from where Judge Oldham left off. I was an academic for a number of years, hopefully not guilty of some of the things you mentioned. But, you know, there is a tremendous gap between what academics are doing with respect to originalism and the kind of practical originalist questions we face when we have novel issues that come before us. And perhaps the D.C. Circuit does have its fair share of novel separation of powers issues. And so, oftentimes, you know, what we're looking for is a really practical kind of originalism. You know, what is the meaning of a particular term or a particular clause? And often, you know, when you look in the academic literature, there's not a lot of research about those issues. And so then there's a question as an intermediate appellate court, how do you go about addressing a novel question that isn't well covered by Supreme Court or circuit precedent? And so I guess I can speak a little bit to some of the things that I've done when cases like that have come before me. I think a first step, and I think this is true for judges but also for advocates, is to really thoroughly canvass the existing case law, because oftentimes a problem seems to be wholly novel, but there is more in the case law than perhaps one might appreciate just by looking at kind of the greatest hits, you know, which is what, you know, judges and advocates often revert to, you know, the common catchphrases, the opinions that everyone always looks at. They're often older cases, maybe separate writings or dissents from cases that are less well known, where maybe you will start to see certain aspects of a problem fleshed out by judges in the past. And I think one of the helpful things about doing a very thorough survey of the existing case law is that it allows a judge and an advocate, perhaps, when writing a brief, to really precisely pinpoint what question is open. You know, what exactly is the novel or open question here? And it might be somewhat different than it seems at first glance. So I think being armed with the full range of what's already out there is very helpful. And then, hopefully the briefs in a case that presents a novel question will have some originalist research, although I think oftentimes because of time and resources, you know, we don't see that much originalist briefing on the D.C. Circuit. I'm surprised by how few amicus briefs we have, even in certain high-profile and important cases. Not necessarily calling for more amicus briefs, but sometimes I'm a little surprised that there isn't more amicus participation in some of the cases that I've seen. So then, you know, what's the next step? I mean, oftentimes, really, I think you just have to, as a judge, you know, roll up your sleeves and get into the meat of things. And as Judge Newsom said, this is often really difficult. Where do you look? Have you, you know, thoroughly canvassed old cases, the Federalist Papers, other sources of meaning? I think we're lucky to live in a time when there are so many resources available online. So I think the online resources have improved tremendously. So you can get some good work done even in chambers with limited time and resources. But I've also seen, I mean, depending on the nature of the case, I mean, if it's a separation of powers issue, oftentimes it's important to look to see what the political branches have done, you know, what has their practice been on a particular issue. And in that vein, I think the practice of the political branches can't change the original meaning, but it might shed some light on what that original meaning is. And that research is often very difficult, going back and just reading debates in the congressional record, correspondence between Congress and the executive branch. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of material, and it is a very difficult path. So that's one way to go. I think also seeing, Justice Thomas's originalist opinions. One of the things that I think he does that is so important is to really look at the foundations of the law. You know, we're not just looking at the words in abstract or maybe, you know, whatever sources or cases from Pennsylvania we can find from the 1700s. What's the political philosophy that informed the framers? What were they reading and thinking about? What was the natural law? What were the natural law ideas that informed their understanding of law? What common law concepts were they familiar with and thinking about? And so those deeper background principles, you know, becoming informed about those and how they impact original meaning, that makes the enterprise, I think, that much more difficult. So it is a hard road. But I guess I'll say a few things. I think I also, one other thing to consider is that many of these questions about separation of powers ultimately boil down to similar questions about, you know, what is the content of the legislative power? You know, what is the content of the executive power and the judicial power? And these questions are all interrelated and intertwined. And so even when a case may seem novel, there might be analogies from other contexts that can be brought to bear on a novel question. And so there may be more thinking and reasoning out there than is immediately apparent. But maybe with that, I'll stop here. Yeah.
Great, thank you. Does anybody have any comments on what they just heard? Judge Jones?
I agree with everything everyone said. but one thing I found very useful in just generally preparing myself for the breadth of issues that come before us is, I'm sorry, but this may be a sad parody of that old saw about doing legislative history by looking over the crowd and picking out who you like. But I have found over the years that there are certain scholars whose reputations for probity and whose general alignment with a traditional view of the law and the foundations of American society are worth paying close attention to and delving into. And so I'd list a few of those. One is Philip Hamburger, who's written his breadth of his work is increasingly amazing. He's written definitive works on religious freedom in the United States, on what he called law and judicial duty, on the administrative state. He's written on 501c3. He's got another book out more recently. Another person I regard highly is Professor Ralph Rossum at Claremont, PhD in political science in the Straussian School, written very penetrating books about both Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia's jurisprudence. I like to read Randy Barnett. I may not always agree with Professor Barnett, but he's an accurate scholar, and he tells us things that are very important to know in an era in which control of our economy is very much up in the air right now. I love to read Richard Epstein. On certain subjects, I look to publications from the Boyd and Gray Center for Administrative Law. They had a seminar this year on the 75th anniversary of the Administrative Procedure Act. Well, we all know that's at the forefront of the court's thinking, and they are getting into some historical aspects of that that are very interesting. And then, you know, not all originalism goes back to the 18th century. Some of it goes back only to the 60s and 70s. And we expect a great deal of litigation on voting, redistricting. And a friend of mine named Abigail Thernstrom wrote a book long ago called Whose Votes Count? About the history of the implementation of the Voting Rights Act. So if, you know, as you watch current literature come out, you will find books. In fact, I've seen some of those books in a couple of the justices' libraries as well. So you look for the good books and read them when you can, and that all lends to your background to be able to deal with more challenging issues.
Does anyone else have any suggestions on sources or things you look to or have found particularly helpful?
I mean, I guess I would just echo what Judge Oldham said, and I think he might have more specific suggestions even than I do. You know, you heard all of us say that this is hard to do, and I mean, in some ways, this is sort of a plea for help. It's a plea for help because for two reasons. One, sort of at a theoretical level, we exist in an adversary system, and so we can only do so much, sort of appropriately. Given the arguments that are put before us, if I'm not suggesting, for instance, that we are sort of bound down to the specific cases that parties are citing to us, of course we know that's not true. But we have a limited range of options given the cases that you bring to us, what we can do with them. And so if you want courts to do originalism and to do it well, then you need to sort of bring the arguments to us. We are by nature a passive instrument of government, and so we need the arguments brought to us. The second piece of that, not just if you want it done, but if you want it done well, then we really need help, both from the lawyers in the audience and from the academics in the audience. Because even if I were sort of footloose and fancy free to do whatever old thing I want in any case, to sort of swim down to the bottom of the sea on every question, I'm just not necessarily going to do it as well, even with this merry band of genius law clerks that I have who make me look better than I am. We're not going to do it as well as we would if the parties very robustly had brought the full sort of force of their argumentation to bear on the court. And so that's sort of like a background plea, but I think Judge Oldham might have even more like specific suggestions you know, for sort of source material and where you might get it.
Yeah. Well, let me make two points, or two to pick up right where Judge Newsom left off. One of my favorite books that I've used for years that I have in paper, although you don't need it in paper, it's on the internet, is The Founder's Constitution by Lerner and Kurland, which I think is incredibly helpful. It's organized by constitutional clause. So when you have a question about, you know, Article 1, Section 9, fill in the blank, you can just turn straight to that particular clause in the book, and it's got whatever, 15, 20, depending on the clause, on whatever clause is at issue, some number of sources, and it has excerpts from those with the citations so you can figure out where to go find the full source. And I think it's incredibly helpful as a starting point. But I offer that with the second proposition, which is a huge caveat, and that is that I think one of the greatest hazards in originalism, and there's no better time to talk about this than in a meeting like this, is to think that that is sufficient, because I have realized over the years, and I've given a series of talks about the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, for example, that, and I'm sure everyone, I'm certainly guilty of this, maybe none of you might be, but I certainly am, where it's like you find something in a Federalist paper and you think, oh, I'll just cite also Federalist 51 as a sort of supportive citation for whatever it is that you are arguing. And there's a tendency to do that, I think, when all you know about a particular topic is what you just found in the Founder's Constitution in 10 minutes because you just found it on the internet or you happen to have one on your shelf, and think that, oh, I've now liquidated the meaning of this particular constitutional provision because I've got this really old citation for it. And in many ways, that is, not only is it not good, it's affirmatively undermining the originalist proposition, right, which is that we're not looking for old citations. You can find those with relative ease on the internet. What we're looking for is the original public meaning of the clause, and that takes way more. And so I think, you know, we can offer, there's all sorts of things. I'm sure everyone in this room would have a different favorite when it comes to sort of how to start an originalist question. But starting the originalist question, although important, is just that. It's the start. It is not the answer. It is not the end. And so I think getting all the way to the end and feeling confident that, no, I've now actually figured out what self-incrimination meant in 1789 or 1792 is way harder.
Judge Rao, anything?
Sure.
Well, on sources?
On sources, I agree with what's been said. I do think there are some helpful online sources. I would also, I guess, maybe just mention one other issue, which is that oftentimes the constitutional issues, at least on my circuit, are not properly exhausted before the agency. And I have seen so many interesting issues and cases sort of not, you know, we can't reach them because they haven't been exhausted in the proper way before an agency, even though the constitutional challenge is important and interesting. So I think that is something, you know, I think Judge Oldham mentioned that, you know, we see the cases sort of as they come to us. And so it's very important for litigants sort of, you know, from the very beginning to get the issues into a case, whether it's before an agency or a district court, that they want to litigate all the way through. I've just seen that in a number of contexts.
Let me add, I'll just kind of use my prerogative here. There is a source guide from Judd Campbell at the University of Richmond and Will Bode, a source guide with sources on kind of early constitutional, dictionaries, papers. It's an article that gets updated on SSRN constantly, and they can point you in the right direction, at least the start. I have found it helpful. Again, it's, originalism is a little bit scary because sometimes, like Judge Oldham said, you're not sure you've gone down every road, and that's a worry. But anyway, that article I would recommend to those of you that are interested in a starting place at least.
Let me just add one thing. There are a lot of times when originalism informs what we are deciding, even though, at least in my case, out of intellectual modesty, I'm not going to write a tome about the 18th century, 19th century practices. So if you do enough work to point us in the right direction, we can decide. You don't have to be Moses of originalism, and you can just point us in the right direction.
What do you all do? Let's maybe drill down a little deeper. If you have a case where you think there should be an originalist argument or originalism is implicated, let's say, but the parties are not really making the argument, or you know, obviously we've got the party presentation principle. We all respect the adversarial system greatly. I mean, it's the way we get to the right answers, I think. But what do you do? Do you ask for additional briefing? Have you gone back to parties with very specific questions? You know, can you give us more information? I mean, perhaps the most famous example is in Brown versus Board, right? The Supreme Court went back and asked an original intent question. Or are you all just inclined to kind of, you know, use it as a starting point and then do your own digging?
I mean, I guess I would just sort of reiterate what I said earlier, both because of the adversarial system and party presentation, and because, frankly, like Judge Jones says, I'm not sure I have enough confidence in myself, you know, to sort of know where all the bodies are buried. I think I would rather have the help. So I think if it were me, I would, especially before writing sort of originalism into a majority opinion that will become the holding of the court, I would rather hear from the parties to make sure, A, that they've had their say, and B, that we've had the fullest possible airing of the issues in sort of an adversarial clash. Because I think, as Judge Oldham points out, originalism and like historical analysis generally are not the same thing. They might look alike, but they're not the same thing, and we're certainly not after finding, you know, what Judge Oldham was describing earlier, finding the old 1720s era CCD case from Pennsylvania to put at the end of your sentence. That's an advocacy move, right? I mean, like, so when I was a lawyer, I always joke, but right before I was nominated, I had essentially become a pharma lawyer. I had sort of an appellate and legal strategy practice, and by and large, the guys who were paying the bills were the pharma companies. And I knew in advance that the answer in my question, or in my cases, was that this common law cause of action is preempted by federal law. I knew that. I knew the common law cause of action was preempted. Now we just need to figure out how best to explain that the common law cause of action is preempted. And although that's not originalism, that is reasoning in reverse. And so I would find the magic citation to put at the end of the sentence in the same way that Judge Oldham was describing. If you're doing sort of faux originalism, then what you do is you figure out the answer in advance, and then you find the 1720s era CCD case from Pennsylvania, you stick it at the end of your sentence, and you say, look, I'm an originalist, and sort of you feed it to the court. That's advocacy, which is fine, but that's not what we do. We're not advocates, you hope. We're not advocates. And so we need sort of advocacy from both sides and full, you know, sort of soup to nuts advocacy from both sides, especially with respect to these originalism arguments, that, you know, it just kind of requires an army to get these things right, is that, you know, sort of go back to where I started. It's really, really hard to do this. And I guess you're never quite sure, 100% certain, that you've nailed it. But there are better and worse ways to go about this, and for my money, the better way to go about it is to get as much input as you possibly can. So certainly before I would write it into a majority opinion, I would want to hear from both sides. I guess the calculus is a little bit different if you're going to write something separate that's not going to bind the parties before you. But I think best practice is probably to get as much input as you can. I don't know if other people see it differently.
Yeah, my preference is to often do them separately for that very reason, which is to say, you know, here's a constitutional provision I've now thought about with some effort and energy. Here's a good faith effort to try to figure out what this particular provision means, how this sits or doesn't sit particularly well with the current state of precedent, and, you know, in the upshot of that being, this doesn't really bind anybody. This is just my attempt to do it. And one of the reasons I think it's an important exercise is that, to go back to the sort of beginning of our conversation on the panel, is that I see all of this as part of a conversation, right? And it's a clause by clause conversation that is not a one-shot deal where we just do it one time in one case, but instead we're trying over time to come up with a more and more refined understanding of what a particular provision of the Constitution means. And so you can, I don't think there's any harm in a certain degree of humility in saying, I obviously don't have all the right answers. I don't know this is 100% correct, but I've spent a good faith amount of time and really tried to grapple with this, to look at cases on both sides, to look at arguments on both sides, and then to show your work. Right? That's part of the whole, my background is in science and math before I, into my parents' chagrin, moved off to law school. But one of the things you learn if you do hard sciences is that you show your work, right? You write out the proof, you explain how you got there, and if somebody has a problem with it, they can come in and say, this is where you erred, right? This is where you went off the road and you made a mistake, and then we can refine that in another case. I think it's way easier to do that in a separate writing. So I think it's partly on us to contribute to the conversation, but as I said before, I think it can't be just the judiciary trying to grapple with these originalist propositions.
Let me ask you, so if I'm in a district court, obviously I know who my audience is. And if I'm in the Supreme Court, I know who my audience is. If I'm in a court of appeals, federal court of appeals, I don't really know beforehand. And in some courts of appeals with a lot of judges, you have no idea. What should advocates do about, there may be some judges that are originalists, maybe there are some judges who are not. Obviously, we've got a new administration, we've got a new crop of judges every 4 years, that can change. What should an advocate do in terms of presenting kind of non-originalist arguments? I'm assuming you play to win the game, as Herm Edwards said, but, Can you elaborate on that, any of you?
I think one way to look at it is to read ACLU briefs, and ACLU briefs sort of often act as if originalism never existed. So if you're on the other side of the ACLU, then you have to talk about originalism and make the other side respond. I was on a panel or listening to a panel recently where prominent Supreme Court lawyer said that she had to hire Clarence Thomas clerks who could tell her about originalism, whatever it is, so they could make those arguments, whatever they are. So they don't really care about it. And you're going to be on the other side and you have to address, and particularly in the district court, which has a lot of the power. You know, we only get to appeal, hear the appeals, of the side who loses, but we have a generation of new, extraordinarily competent district judges who are writing very wonderful opinions, and you want to make your arguments to those people or even to the other people so that if you lose, you can appeal to our side. But, every advocate does whatever port is in a storm. But a convincing originalist argument will go a long way with many judges on the courts now.
Yeah, I guess I would just say, I think that, and this is not single-handedly the work of Justices Scalia and Thomas, but wow, have they advanced the conversation in a sort of a paradigm-shifting kind of way, such that an entire generation of lawyers, kind of my generation, thinks about the law in a certain way. And originalism, whether or not you're a thoroughgoing originalist or textualist or not, you respect those modes of argumentation. And so I think it's quite unlikely that you're going to make a formalist, originalist slash textualist argument, depending on the kind of case that you have before you, that's going to alienate many judges these days. Having said that, I do think that from an advocate's perspective, you owe it to your client to put all of your best foot forward. So, you know, whether you personally, you know, Josh McGeggy, are a thoroughgoing originalist, when you come to us, you know, you've got to be loaded for bear, all of it. And so, you know, if you've got non-originalist arguments to make that serve your client's interest, then as I think as a matter of sort of ethical obligation to your client, you should be making those arguments. You know, that is not to say that you should be kicking your originalist arguments to the side. I just think it's pretty unlikely that you're going to alienate judges by making them. So I think you have to, it's like a both and. It's not an either or, it's a both and. That's my sense.
Let me throw out another sort of hurdle, I think, do we have to a lot of this. If we can take a step back even before lawyers and advocates making arguments in particular cases, I think another challenge is, what about law schools? And what are, because I know we have a lot of law students in the audience and recent law graduates. One of the things I think is really interesting is the disconnect between the way courts consider constitutional questions these days and the way law schools teach them. And so, you know, especially if you're a recent law school graduate and you're confronting a constitutional question, maybe you either didn't serve as a law clerk or didn't serve as a law clerk for a judge who thinks a lot about originalism and originalist questions. What do you do? How do you even start to make these arguments? What without the tools having been taught to you or gone through a class or some sort of sharpening iron process to figure out exactly how to do it? And I think that's a real challenge. I think it's. I'm not really sure. I was always sort of operating in the assumption that as courts are increasingly asking originalist questions, as courts are increasingly writing originalist decisions, or at least attempting in some way to do that, that the conversation would continue to evolve to the point where this would sort of percolate into the law school curriculums and would be taught in a way that we can have some evaluation of good originalism versus bad originalism versus half-hearted originalism or whatever. And I'm not sure that that debate is even going on, such that then when we ask litigants to be able to do this in courtrooms, I'm not sure exactly how best to do that. So I guess it goes back to something that Judge Newsom said earlier, which is that in many ways it's a plea for help, because I think it really, really starts at the latest in law school. And as far as I can tell, that's an underserved need.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I think it's certainly, you know, making originalist arguments, it seems to me that if you make a strong originalist argument, there are essentially three ways that someone on the other side can respond. They can just say that originalism doesn't matter, it's a bad method. I think it's great that we've evolved to a place where you rarely see that as a response, either from advocates or judges, right? Most people agree that originalism matters, at least to some extent. I think that the second answer you get is, well, maybe that's the original meaning, but we have to go with precedent anyway, and that's what's important, so we don't care about the original meaning because we care about precedent. I think that's the second answer. And then really the third answer I think we see more and more frequently is if, you know, when you're presented with a strong originalist argument, if you disagree or you want to reach, you know, if a judge wants to reach a different outcome, then they have to go ahead and do their own originalist research to rebut the arguments that are made. And I think that is the most, you know, that's the most productive way that we can hopefully start to refine our answers about what the law means and what the original meaning of various clauses are. So I think, you know, continuing to make those arguments is one way to keep that dialogue going. Whether a judge ends up writing in a separate opinion, a dissent or a concurrence, or maybe those arguments make it into a majority, I think it's very important for advocates to go ahead and make those, you know, even when they don't know who the panel might be, because it poses a kind of challenge to, I guess, both to the judge and to the advocates on the other side.
Can I just pick up on one thing that Judge Oldham said, accounting for the fact that there likely are a number of law students in the room, and I don't want to take for granted that all of the law students in the room are already dyed-in-the-wool originalists. You may not be. I mean, frankly, when I was I didn't have a clue when I was a first-year law student, second-year law student, really what originalism really meant. I think a lot of law students are more sophisticated today than I was then. it's a low bar. But I didn't know. I mean, people ask me a lot, I'm often asked sort of how did you sort of come into your judicial philosophy? And the honest truth is, I kind of backed into it because what happened to me is I got to Harvard, dating myself, but I got to Harvard in 1994, and I wasn't sure at all how the law was supposed to be done. And I looked around and pretty quickly realized, I think I know how it's not supposed to be done. By basically, sort of just like, sort of, how do I kind of want this to come out? It's all just, sort of what the judge ate for breakfast. The judge can do whatever he wants, can drive whatever results she wants. And I just thought, boy, maybe I'm naive or Boy Scoutish or Pollyannish or something, but I just don't think that's right. And so I kind of backed my way in to this sort of, for lack of a better way to describe it, sort of formalist way of thinking about the law, believing that the law, as I said earlier, is an objective thing, that it, there's not necessarily in every case a right answer and a wrong answer, but there are better answers and worse answers. I like actually believe that. And so I guess I would just say to the seekers, right, to the law student seekers in the room, don't be afraid of the fact that you don't yet quite know how this is supposed to be done, but be open to the idea that there is sort of objectivity in the law, and don't be sort of cowed by law school culture into believing that it has to be a sort of result orientation in every case. I just don't think that's true. It was not true for me as a law student, it was not true for me as a lawyer, and it's certainly not true in my experience as a judge. So I would just say to the law students in the room, sort of maintain an open mind and be receptive to the idea that originalism in constitutional interpretation, textualism in statutory interpretation, may well find it to be the best and most proper way to go about it. I just wanted to do that before we got away from the student piece. That's my soapbox speech for the afternoon.
Let me ask you this question then, because I know that we've talked, a few of you have alluded to the other side, kind of critics of originalism. And I think for the most part that has meant, I'll just kind of use generalist terms here, but attacks from the left, obviously. We're seeing now some new theories, maybe from the right, common good constitutionalism, common good originalism. Do you all see those theories kind of gaining traction? Do you think that they could impact the way that we decide cases?
I thought we had decided not to talk about this. That smile.
I thought Judge Oldham volunteered to give us his views.
Yeah, he likes to disagree with me.
That's not true. See, I just did it. I just disagreed.
Disagreeing with Judge Jones is a dangerous place to be.
I was going to say, I don't do it often. I have not seen any discussion of this in cases so far. Obviously I follow a lot of the academic debate over amongst originalists. And I think of this debate like I think of a lot of debates, which I think the debate is generally healthy. And the different ideas should clash, and we should have, an open dialogue. And I think it's a good one to have. But I have not actually seen any form of these sort of different forms of originalism being argued in cases yet.
Judge Rao?
Okay. I guess, I'm not sure that there's just one thing that is common good constitutionalism necessarily from what I've read. But I understand some of the criticisms that are brought in the writings that kind of are under the banner of common good constitutionalism. And I guess one of the ways, at least I see those criticisms, is against a kind of, I want to call it maybe a thin form of textualism or originalism. And this goes back in some ways to what I was saying earlier, is that if you're looking for original meaning, you can't do that divorced from the underlying foundations of the law. You can't really be thinking about original public meaning without having some sense of political philosophy and legal theory and the natural law and, I guess, traditional international law and the common law, and all of these things are part of the foundation of, you know, kind of the soil in which our Constitution was written and enacted. So I think to the extent that some of these critics are pointing at that sort of richer foundation, I think that is a useful way to think about originalism.
Well, I'll weigh in a little bit. I'm friends with proponents of both theories, one of whom is was Justice Scalia, and one of whom was Hadley Arkus. And they spent years engaged in arguments much deeper than I can even conceive in my mind, much less reproduce, about the impact or the jurisprudential application of natural law. What I see it as, of course, none of us who have taken an Article III oath are going to say that we're going to look to the brooding omnipresence in the sky and decide a priori what's right in every case. That kind of argument that natural law means that you're departing from the Constitution and the written law is absurd. It is a grotesque mischaracterization. The principles of natural law are those that are written in the hearts of men from time immemorial, which begins at least at Cicero and before then. So it is common sense founded on common reasoning. Let me give you two or three of the elemental principles of law that used to undergird the thinking of most people. Biology. Retroactivity was viewed as abhorrent to the law, putting consequences on men after the fact. It is improper to take from A and give to B. That was until 100 years or so ago viewed as an elemental principle of the law. Now, where is that in the positive Constitution? It isn't there, but we all think about those kinds of factors when we make decisions. So all I would say about this is that it is a very dangerous enterprise at this point in our extremely tenuous constitutional structure and ability to sustain a constitutional structure to engage in the circular firing squad.
Well said. Judge Newsom, no comments?
Yeah, well, I was with Judge Jones. I thought this was sort of off the table. I mean, I guess the only thing I would say is that, and again, maybe this is more to the students than anybody else in the room, but we have a tendency to talk about the law in terms of the conservatives and the liberals. I get it that those are useful or maybe sort of like they're labels that make us sort of feel sort of warm. I always try to tell the students who I teach on the side as an adjunct that I think the far more interesting divide among judges is between formalists and pragmatists or formalists and functionalists or something like that. And it's not necessarily between political conservatives and political liberals. There may be some overlap, but you know, sort of to the point that I at least began this with, I think if you're doing formalism, again, which I take to encompass both originalism and textualism, I think if you're doing it right, you know, look, sometimes the conservatives are going to love you, sometimes they're going to hate you. Sometimes the libs are going to love you, sometimes they're going to hate you. And that's exactly as it should be. It's just not my job. to drive results in individual cases. It's my job to sort of swear an oath to the Constitution, find the best methodology that I can to implement that oath, and then the results are what they are. And that, if that makes me a conservative, then I guess I'm a conservative. If it makes me something else, then I guess I'm that something else. But I just sort of view this as almost like as a category error to call people conservatives and liberals. I just think that it's a methodology, and the methodology, it's not mechanistic necessarily, but it produces the results that it produces. And sometimes those in this room may love those from me. Sometimes I'm guessing you may not like them from me. But all I can do is I can swear to you that I'm doing my level best to sort of implement the methodology that I have convinced myself is the right way to do this job. And if those results go sideways, we live in a democracy, and you know, sort of convince those in the political branches to correct my errors. And so I just want to be sort of careful about thinking about us sort of getting into sloppy thinking about this being just sort of, I don't think that formalism is in the law is like sort of political, or should be, or really is, political conservatism masquerading under some other banner. I think they're just different things. They're just different things. And I hope that doesn't make me a sort of, again, a sort of a Pollyanna, but I actually believe that. For better or worse, I actually believe that, and I try to do it every day. So that's all I would say about it.
Do you think, so we talk about originalism as a method. Is it positive law now? In other words, or can a method be precedential? Is there methodological precedent, or is originalism always going to be kind of fighting in the arena with other methods?
I think we have to recognize that for the entirety of my existence on Earth, the idea of traditionalism versus what we now call progressivism has been represented of political and cultural clashes. I do not see that abating short of a national disaster. And so in the large societal sense, we are Manichaean in that way. Some people contend that that's inherent in liberal democracy. Others might contend that that is inherent in a society which is losing faith in God. But if you just want to put it on the day-to-day basis, who's going to argue a Second Amendment case today without arguing originalism? It ain't going to happen, because the Supreme Court set the proper tone for that. You know, at some point there may be a basis for a serious reconsideration of the Commerce Clause. I'm telling you, we're entering an era in which there's very great challenge to the economy. Are we going to start looking at criminal procedure standards in a different way, based on originalist concepts, which are pretty far divorced from the Fourth and the Fifth Amendment as we now know them? I sort of doubt it, but I suppose anything is possible. I am interested in what I think Andy mentioned just in passing yesterday. Are we about to do away with tiers of review? Because I don't think the common law understood tiers of review. And I thought that, you know, loosey-goosey and meaningless as they are, they're embedded in First Amendment law. But maybe Andy has some methodological way to get around that.
I will just say... Let me answer it this way. I do think it's interesting that we have very different precedential approaches to different constitutional provisions. So I do think it's interesting that, you know, as Judge Jones points out, you can read both opinions in Heller, and you can come away with the conclusion that whatever the right answer is between Justice Scalia and Justice Stevens, that we're all originalists now, as many have said. But you could read, you know, from the same October term of the Supreme Court, a First Amendment case about time, place, and manner restrictions, if there were such a case that term, and you'd have a very different view about the First Amendment, even though they're, you know, obviously part of the same Bill of Rights and adopted by the same people. Tiers of scrutiny apply in one, and there's the sort of more history and tradition that applies in the other. And so I do think that's interesting. So to the original question prompt about whether originalism is part of positive law, is there precedent that compels this approach? I just think one fascinating thing and a real challenge for the inferior courts of the United States is that it depends on the clause. It's all the same constitution, obviously, but in some clauses the approach is dictated, and in others it's not.
I guess I might answer the question a little bit different way. I think the question that may be more hotly disputed is whether the Constitution is a positive law, right? And so there's a lot of ongoing debate about whether the Constitution itself is a positive law. I think the Constitution is a positive law, absolutely. And so then I think that the best way to interpret the Constitution is by looking to the original public meaning. So to me, I think the, I'm not sure that the methodology has to be part of the positive law, but I think the prior question is the most important. Is the Constitution itself a positive law? And I think it is, so.
I think we should open it up to audience questions. I don't know, we've got some microphones.
Circular firing squad.
Never. Aha.
Never.
Well, everyone's here now. I'd like to. Does this work? Does this work?
Yeah.
I'd like to rise to Edith's cue, but just offer reflections for my friends on the panel. Lyman Trumbull assured his colleagues up and down that nothing in this new 14th Amendment was going to challenge those laws in Illinois as well as Virginia that barred marriage across racial lines. And he knew that if he couldn't give that assurance, that 14th Amendment didn't have a ghost of a chance of passing. So I put the question once to one of our friends at the Supreme Court, does that mean you should not have done Loving versus Virginia? He said, well, I'll have to think about it. But you know darn well they'd not go back and redo Loving versus Virginia. What we say now is that Trumbull didn't understand the real depth of his principles. Not all of us see all the implications arising at any time from all of our principles. That's the way life is. Now we think we can give an account of that principle. It has something to do with the fact that we can't draw moral inferences about people, about their worth, as though race determined their quality. Well, that wasn't explained by Lyman Trumbull, nor was it explained by William Graham Sumner. So that just as we don't take Lyman Trumbull, the fact that he said it, it's an old thing, we don't accept that as determining the law. The problem is that it's not settled either. When we point to, say, that Mike McConnell points out that William Graham or Sumner did think the 14th Amendment was at odds with racial segregation.
Is there a question? Do we have a question?
No.
Yeah.
I would offer this reflection. It's a version of the youth of Rome. Is it old because it is good, or we've made it old because we think there's something resoundingly good about it? Some of us study Hamilton and Marshall because they trace their judgments back to those anchoring principles that were there even before the Constitution and promise to be true even now. So why my point is, saying it's old does not exactly settle the case.
Any response?
Hi. Re-alternating? Hi, my name's Eric. I'm a student at Georgetown Law. I wanted to pick up on something that Judge Rao had mentioned about concurrences. When Supreme Court precedent conflicts with original meaning, Do you all think that using dicta or concurrences is an effective way to advance originalism within the constraints that you have as a lower court judge?
I mean, I guess I can just say this from sort of personal experience. I mentioned very briefly, and we don't have the time or the energy, I think, to swim all the way down into this standing issue that I've raised. But I like this concurring opinion, this 57-page concurring opinion that I wrote, this sort of unburdening about sort of Article III standing, I recognized both before I wrote it in a case called Spokio versus Robbins and since I wrote it, in a case called TransUnion versus Ramirez, the Supreme Court has said, in effect, Newsom, you're wrong. Is that reason not to do it? I actually just don't think it is, for the reasons that Judge Oldham suggested. Again, I sort of, right or wrong, I'm not trying necessarily to suggest that, like, I've figured this out and everybody else is wrong. It's like, I've thought about this for a long time, and I've tried my best to kind of reason my way through it from an originalist perspective, and I think this is a better way to think about it. And that is not the end of the conversation, it's the beginning of the conversation. As Nick Saban said when he won his first national championship, this is not the end, this is the beginning. It's Roll Tide. It's part of, you would hope that it's part of an organic conversation. So I think in answer to the question from me anyway, the answer is it's a perfectly passable thing to do. And maybe it gains adherence in 5 years, maybe it gains adherence in 20 years, maybe it never gains adherence. But not for the want of trying.
Judge Ho wrote a concurrence in a little case that's up before the Supreme Court called Dobbs and suggested that Roe v. Wade should be overruled. So, yeah, of course they have an effect when the time is ripe.
Great. How about way in the back?
Okay. I have a question about Rodriguez de Quijas and Bossie. You know, this objection gets made to originalism. Supreme Court doesn't have enough time. Lower court judges have some time on their hands. And rather than having concurrences that are sort of cert petitions or draft cert petitions, the court could go back to the rule that they followed in cases like West Virginia School Board versus Barnett. So West Virginia lost the case at the trial court that disagreed basically with Gabaitis, and the court didn't say anything about, well, lower courts have to follow our holdings. So what do you think about the advisability of reconsidering Rodriguez de Quijas or Bossie about lower courts just straight up having the power to say, hey, Supreme Court, you got it wrong in this earlier case. We think you would overrule this. What do you think about that?
That's a real easy answer. If you want us to do that, do you want people who don't believe in originalism to do that? We're in a hierarchical system that would destroy the what stability we have in the rule of law.
How about up here?
Hello, David McDonald from Mountain States Legal Foundation. I've found corpus linguistics to be interesting. It's like a promising tool in the originalist toolbox, but I've been afraid to use it in advocacy because I'm not sure how judges will feel about it. I'm curious what the panel thinks about corpus linguistics and originalism.
I'll say I share the reservation largely from at least my perceived ignorance about how best to do it and how to. One of the things I think is a real challenge when it comes to any of these things is that I think it's very tempting to find, you know, a corpus linguistics site or whatever, and you run your search, you find some things you like, and you use it, and you point to corpus linguistics as inherently supporting your argument. And I think it just makes me nervous without feeling well trained in it and understanding its provenance, knowing that the Supreme Court. As Judge Jones pointed out, you know, we are in a system of a vertical hierarchy, And so sort of branching out to use new tools, especially in majority opinions, is difficult. But I think also in a concurring opinion where you're just speaking for yourself, I think it's really important to feel like you made a really good faith effort to understand something. And so I'm not sure that corpus linguistics has gotten to the place now where there's enough, at least on the bench, which is the sort of perspective we're supposed to be offering here, enough practitioners of it to be to the same place that we are with some of these other tools and other methods that we use for originalist inquiry. But that's just speaking for me. I'm sure that there are many members of the federal judiciary who would say, absolutely, make your argument, and we'll evaluate it the same way we would, you know, any other originalist argument.
Thank you. In the way back again.
Good afternoon. My name is Dwayne Horning. I'm in private practice in San Diego, California. When I hear about the formulaic textual and originalist method and how one should start at the beginning and just work it through and it leads where it leads without having a predetermined outcome, I greatly respect and admire that process. But it brings to mind the old law versus equity division in the chancery courts, and of course where now we have today unified courts. So my question is, when the court is doing an originalist or textualist analysis, is there ever a place, maybe after getting to the end, to take a step back, now wearing the hat of equity, and evaluate, is this getting to the right and just result? And if there is a place for that, then is that an opportunity for equity to swallow the rule and get us right back to whatever the judge thinks is right kind of a problem? Or how does that interplay work?
All right, I'll give it a shot. I think, for better or worse, my answer to your fundamental question, is there room to take a step back and say, is this the just result, is no. I hope that doesn't make me a bad person. I teach this jurisprudence class on the side. I've got one of my students in the audience. And, you know, we talked about formalism and realism a couple of weeks ago. And I said, and I believe, that if you believe in the separation of powers, if you believe that we fundamentally live in a democracy, and you believe in the separation of powers, then the judge's job, again, I hope this doesn't make me a bad person, isn't to drive just results in individual cases. It's to decide the case as best he or she can according to the law written on the page, and then let the chips fall where they may, and if it's crazy enough, then you hope that the political branches will step in to do what they should do, which is to create a just society. I hope that's not too simple-minded, but that's my sort of fundamental view of what my role is. I don't know if others have different views about that. Hearing none, I'll take that as acclamation.
Thanks. Lori Ann Updike-Toller. I teach First Amendment law in Boston, and I do teach an originalism section. You spoke of resources. I have long drummed the drum about practical resources for originalism and helped to start the Constitutional Sources Project, or CONSource. If you're looking for something with a constitutional index that links to sources, you can find it there. But I wanted to ask two questions, if I may. One is, if historical amici were presented to your courts that were in favor of neither party and really dug into the history in a helpful, practical way, would that be welcomed by you?
I would pay. Yeah.
That would be incredibly helpful for okay. A lot of these cases, yes.
Hoping to start a constitutional history clinic. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, I absolutely would be helpful, but I would say the most helpful thing is I'm grateful for the pedagogy. I think teaching students to ask these questions and teaching them how to do at least some preliminary inquiry into originalism is incredibly helpful. So my gratitude for that. But obviously, yes, I think the amici briefs are helpful too.
Thank you. Second question. I've done an empirical analysis of the court's use of the Constitutional Convention over time, and those justices that I looked at without jurisprudential theories like originalism, or, you know, that Brian Brennan and Thayer are also included here, showed statistically significant deviations from expected political outcomes, meaning that the greater use of history produced constraining results. They deviated politically. We don't see any deviation for Thomas, none, although he uses history to a great extent, in primary sources specifically. But for the originalist justices that we looked at, there was not significant deviation. And what I hear Judge Newsom and others saying is, if this is a method that has bite that we're committed to, there should be more significant deviation. How do we encourage that type of jurisprudential approach on the court if we're seriously committed to originalism?
I'm sorry, what is the what are you measuring the deviation from precisely?
Expected political outcomes. There's a Martin Quinn score of expected political outcome, political decisions by the justices. It goes back to 1935.
Why don't you tell us what our scores are, and then we'll open it.
I'm going to plead the fifth.
So I would just say one thing briefly. There's a different kind of deviation, which is deviation from the method, right? I mean, I think we can all, you can all think probably of deviations from the method. Like, so for instance, Judge Jones brought up the Commerce Clause. Maybe this is personal to me, because when I was Alabama's SG, I was involved in a case at the Supreme Court called Gonzalez versus Raich, the medical marijuana case, and I filed a brief on the what I call the pot side of the case, saying basically that, you know, California's got this goofy law, and if California wants to have a goofy law, that's the reason we live in a federalist system. And long story short, so we lost, right? Our side lost, and Justice Scalia was on what I'll call the other side. He was on the other side of the case. But I think, and I've said this to law students and young lawyers before, what's beautiful about that, and so to me, I can sort of look at that and think anyway, that was a deviation from method, from Justice Scalia, the champion of this. To me, that sort of feels like a deviation from method. But what makes this so great to me, and what I find frankly kind of inspiring, is that those deviations are so few and far between that you can point them out. Like, I can say to this sophisticated group of people, Gonzalez versus Raich was a deviation in method, and some of you, I hope at least some of you are like, yeah, it kind of was, but you'd have to like rack your brains to think about the next one. And isn't that great that we are like living in this period of sort of constitutional dialogue that originalism has sort of taken hold, at least to an extent, that among our heroes, we can count the deviations like on a single hand. That's pretty great. It's pretty great. So instead of complaining about sort of those deviations, I think we should celebrate the fact that they're few and far between.
Can I add one point, which is that, so obviously I don't know anything about this index and how things are scored one way or the other, but one thing I have found frustrating every time I have peered over the wall to look at this in the academy about the way some of these empirical studies are done, is I don't understand how you can assign scores to one side or another with respect to a lot of the constitutional questions that we get. So for example, a lot of the constitutional questions that we see anyway in the Court of Appeals are under the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. And so I'm not really sure what Justice Scalia, famed, a champion of Crawford and the Confrontation Clause, and had originalist arguments that in his mind convinced him of his understanding of what the Confrontation Clause meant and what it meant to confront witnesses against you. Does that score on some index, and if so, how and why, and what would be sort of an expected outcome with respect to an understanding of a warrantless search and the Fourth? I'm just not sure I understand the kind of the project in doing it, and I think that captures a large swath of the constitutional litigation that we see in federal courts. Is not the stuff that folks are often talking about under the Second Amendment or the 14th Amendment.
I think we're in the back.
Oh. Hi, thank you for the panel. I found the discussion very interesting. This question is primarily for Judge Rao, but feel free, you can take, anyone can respond. Judge Rao, you mentioned in your remarks that, I'm paraphrasing, but you come across a case and there is an originalist dimension to it, and the originalism answer is not obvious. So you would look to the case law, which would seem you might find a lot of wisdom there, but maybe not. And so I wonder, math people talk about the order of operation. If you look to the case law first, you run the risk of sort of polluting or contaminating your thinking if you had taken a look at it without the benefit of looking at someone's history the case law, which again might not have a lot of wisdom. Is there a concern about that?
Well, I think as a intermediate appellate court, we have to be mindful of the precedent from the Supreme Court and our respective circuits. And so my comments were really designed to say that often there's more in the case law than maybe is immediately apparent, and people don't often go back and carefully read the cases, so you might find something there. But if you don't, but at least you'll have a sense of, what are the questions that are not answered by the cases, right? Where are the gaps? Where is the true issue of first impression? And so I don't think looking at the cases necessarily skews that perspective, because I think it just helps you to identify the question. And then once you've identified the question, you can go back and look at the historical sources to try to answer that question.
Okay, thank you.
Let's take a couple more right here.
Thank you. Michael Isaac from Tampa, Florida. Federal 78 tells us that the judicial branch is the weakest of the three branches. Its power is to be limited to that of judgment. And Judge Rao, you made a very interesting comment in your original statement about the separation of powers. And in previous discussions I've heard on originalism, what ordinarily goes non-discussed or undiscussed in great detail is how protecting the separation of powers and judicial restraint plays an integral part in originalism. So I'm interested to hear perhaps if you could explore that to a little bit greater extent and from a pragmatic point of view. Bostick is probably the perfect example of how a decision was presented as textualistic, but in reality, they stepped into the shoes of legislators and gave the petitioner relief that they couldn't get from the Congress.
Can you just repeat your question? I'm sorry.
Well, you had talked about separation of powers as part of originalism. And what typically goes, you don't hear a lot of discussions about how the nuance of protecting separation of powers and judicial restraint plays into originalism. So I'm just hoping that you can expound on that a little bit.
Sure. I think one of the things that's interesting of every separation of powers question even if it's not directly this way, involves a question about what is the proper scope of the judicial power in answering that separation of powers question. And so I take your point that there's often a question about the role that the judge should play in a particular case, especially in disputes between the political branches. So I do think that's a very important aspect of every separation of powers case. And then there are questions about what's the original understanding of the judicial power. How far does it reach? What is a proper case or controversy? And I think that's inherent in all of these hard cases about separation of powers.
Can I say just one thing about that briefly? I think the difficulty of sort of unhinged, amethodological judicial supremacy is that it's just totally corrosive of the political process and like civic engagement more generally. If, as a society, we have come to believe that the federal courts exist to right every wrong, you're gonna see this is kind of a soapbox issue of mine, but if we've come to believe that the federal courts exist to right every social wrong, then, as I think is descriptively accurate, the political branches have fallen asleep, and people, frankly, have fallen asleep. Because they assume when it really hits the fan, the federal courts will sort of rescue us from ourselves.
And I just think, wouldn't it be better if the federal courts sort of tied themselves to the mast of some methodology? I'll take originalism, textualism, formalism more generally, but bind yourself to that mast and then force the political branches and the people to re-engage. That just seems like a monumentally better government to me than the one that we're currently sort of toiling under. And it's cyclical, right? It's this vicious cycle. The courts chomp off more, 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 and so the political branches fall deeper and deeper into a slumber, and so do the people. And so the courts have to pick up the slack because the political branches aren't doing anything. And wouldn't it be better if somebody sort of cut the cord and said, we're not doing this anymore? And, you know, there would be some growing pains, but the political branches and the people would have to re-engage in a way that I think they frankly aren't right now.
And that's a very good point. And that was the point that I was trying to make, the byproduct of what's happening when the courts don't engage in appropriate judicial restraint. So we are now viewed by the general public in the same eyes as the political ideology. And so every time the court comes out with a decision, it's never because it's the process. And as you talked about, the process took us from point A to point Z, it's politically motivated. And so that was the whole point of what I was trying to get at.
Let me press Judge Newsom's point a little bit farther, because first of all, we're looking for nirvana, I'm afraid, in suggesting that the impetus of the judiciary is at some point going to reach a state of perfect originalism such that courts are in their rightful place. We're the most litigious society in history, and 20 years ago, it seemed to me that we had finally reached a point of equilibrium about the time of the Glucksberg case, when Justice Rehnquist had a commanding majority of the court on assisted suicide saying, we're not going to mess around with substantive due process anymore. And then only a couple years later, Lawrence happened, and some new rules in the death penalty. What I'm saying is there is an impetus toward using the judiciary for purposes that it is not best suited to serve, and if it's not substantive due process, it's going to be something else. And the other point I'd make is that another consequence of this is that the people who don't care how the judiciary is going to come out find that it is a very worthwhile game to play. And therefore, it is not just in the process of enforcing the law that they exploit what has been done to expand the role of the judiciary before. It is the process is punishment for many people, and that is another way in which the system gets completely warped, and many people don't even realize what's going on.
Thank you.
I think with that, we will thank our panel for their presentations today.